Good morning, everyone. We appreciate everyone getting on the call this morning. It's Andy Levine with the American Seed Trade Association, working through our agenda today to discuss some of the activities that are going on with respect to COVID-19 and issues that we're facing across the country, both at the state level and the federal level. A lot of things happening this past week with respect to the CARES program and other support programs from the Congress and from the administration. So we want to move through those. We've got our general counsel and one of his colleagues will be presenting issues along the lines of sick leave and paycheck protection and tax programs. A lot of these things are evolving rapidly. We want to continue to get your feedback and insight into things that are an issue for you so that we can make sure that we're looking at them both from, again, the national level and the state level, working with our state and regional associations, and then getting the message out to everyone as we go forward. So we hope that all of you are doing well and staying healthy. And while these are pretty stressful times, we anticipate that we'll continue to bring you the messages from the association level that hopefully will help you move through these times with your businesses and your colleagues to address the appropriate issues. As always, we've got our antitrust statement. We want to make sure that people realize that that is on the agenda and that we take that very seriously as we go through these various programs. So if you have any concerns on that, just stop us and we will go forward with that. Without any further ado, I will ask Ellen Zimmerman to move in and give us an overview of some of the resources that we continue to put up on the COVID website at the ASTA, on ASTA's website. So, Ellen, why don't you go ahead and start?
Thanks, Andy, and good morning, everyone. I just wanted to walk through some of the resources that we have available for you all. We're continually updating the COVID-19 webpage within the betterseed.org website that's underneath the news tab. So betterseed.org and then the news tab, you'll see COVID-19 as the first drop-down menu option. When you get on that page, there are three different tabs on the COVID-19 hub. Those are impacts on the seed industry, upcoming ASTA events, and other resources. On the Impacts on Seed Industry tab, you can find information and resources on federal loan programs, essential critical infrastructure workers guidance, immigration and labor updates, including H-2A information, transportation information, including declarations from FMCSA, U.S. Department of Labor guidance for employees, as well as state-by-state international trade and phytosanitary information. On the Other Resources tab, you can find helpful links and documents from USDA, CDC, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, U.S. Department of Treasury, Small Business Administration, NASDA, and the Canadian Seed Trade Association. So all of that can be found on the betterseed.org website on our COVID-19 hub, which is underneath the news tab. And then we also have additional member resources in our member-only portal. So things that can be found in the member-only section are Hogan Lovell's webinar on new employment regulations, and that includes the webinar's recording and slides, Ag Retailers Association signature app, FDA guidance on the food industry, H-2A labor question and answers, labor regulations, which includes templates for COVID-19 infectious disease control policies, PHEL policy update, and emergency paid sick leave policy updates. There's also business guidance on contracts and critical worker resources, which includes a memo prepared by Hogan Lovells and sample template letters. And we're also putting the recorded member calls that we're having on Fridays there so you can reference them later. If you have questions or concerns about getting into the member-only portal, you can reach out to me, ezimmerman@betterseed.org. And then to log in, you go to betterseed.org, and there is a login button in the top left. So that is an overview of the resources that we have available currently, and we're updating those regularly. Jane, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, great. Ellen, thanks so much. And a shout out to our website team who've been updating the websites hourly, it seems, as new information becomes available. So the news coming out of in the critical infrastructure space, so as a reminder, that's the guidance from DHS CISA on what is considered critical infrastructure. They sent out an update on Saturday, and it now explicitly includes seeds as critical infrastructure, which is terrific. They did move us into a different section. So we're now, along with pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers and agricultural production aids. Some of the other elements, the ag input section is still in there. And there's also been some other additions in the language where agribusiness support services are in there. I guess this is a way of saying there's lots of ways you could say that your company is a critical infrastructure. We also, as you may have heard on a previous call, in order to provide some clarity to the industry, we did create a memo that's under Andy's name, and it has been updated with this new guidance information from DHS, so describing all of the elements of the seed industry that we consider to be critical. So if you marry that document up with those templates that Ellen talked about being on our members only website, those templates are for your business to use to give to your employees so they have some paperwork indicating that they are critical infrastructure workers. I've been on a lot of calls with a lot of different associations and companies, and so far it seems that workers are not being pulled over and stopped. Generally, things seem to be going pretty smoothly. But it does seem that most companies have given their workers one of these template documents to carry with them. It is unlikely, as I've mentioned in previous calls, that there will be some sort of federal credentialing for workers. At the moment, it is just companies doing their own thing. One of the efforts we've been participating in, we've signed a number of coalition letters urging all governors to adopt the DHS CISA guidance on critical infrastructure. I was surprised to learn that there's still 11 states who have not followed that guidance, and they're actually ag-heavy states like Iowa, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, even Texas. And, you know, but we haven't heard any issues coming out of those states, but there's a targeted effort by a coalition of organizations to try and convince the governors in those states to adopt this national critical infrastructure worker guidance. It just is very helpful if all the states are operating under the same guidelines. So another thing I wanted to cover this morning, the CARES Act, as Andy mentioned, is that's the big stimulus bill, is quite a lot of conversation about that. Hogan Lovells, fortunately, is going to cover the really meaty portions of it. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the money that's been dedicated to USDA as part of that bill. So there's $9.5 billion in dedicated funds have been given to USDA to help farmers who are experiencing financial loss from coronavirus. And that's targeted support for fruit and vegetable growers, dairy and livestock farmers, and local food producers. And then another $14 billion was to replenish the CCC account. That's been how they've been funding the MFP payments that have been primarily going to the main row crop farmers. So we anticipate that $14 million will again go for MFP payments. So when you look at that $9.5 billion, on a call yesterday, Secretary Perdue said it's probably going to take them a month to figure out what the programs are going to look like for that support. So what I envision is over the next month, between the livestock guys and produce guys and the dairy guys, there's just going to be a lot of jockeying to figure out who gets what pile of money. We have been trying to support the specialty crop groups who are looking for direct support payments for farmers and additional food purchase programs and also some regulatory flexibility. So you'll stay tuned. We'll continue to update you as it becomes clearer where that money is going. But just as a reminder, it is directed to farmers, so your customers versus agribusiness. Owen Lovells is going to talk more about the programs that are available for agribusiness later. So that's my update. Pat, I'll turn it over to you for state issues.
Thanks, Jane. Again, I hope everybody's healthy and safe and hanging in there during these challenging times. As I reported last week, most of the state legislatures have either gone into recess or have adjourned early, or just some of them just it's the time for them to adjourn. So there's not a whole lot of activity. And those that are in session are mostly focusing on COVID-19. So we get a little bit of a respite here and for a couple of months until they kind of get things back in order. About the only thing that we're seeing different is we're seeing a few issues with some small towns that have that are deviating from the federal guidelines for essential businesses. But none of them impact agriculture production directly. They're just a little bit of creativity working there. So next, I wanted to just, there's not a whole lot going on, so there's not a lot to report other than virus activities. I know we invited Chris Zanabini from California to kind of give us an update of some of the programs they're working out there. As I've mentioned before, as goes California, so goes everybody else. So with that, I'll hand it off to Chris for a few minutes.
All right. Thanks, Pat. Not a whole lot of new stuff to report, although, you know, we are seeing some areas here in California, certain counties put pretty restrictive measures in place, particularly in the two hot spots, which would be the San Francisco Bay Area, and then also Los Angeles, which have, you know, severely restricted any kind of activity, particularly with like restaurants and grocery stores. And we're also seeing a ban on construction in the San Francisco Bay Area, which is probably going to expand. I know Napa County has now gone in that direction. And I just think moving forward, we have to be really careful about the ag operations and groups of people being together and having a response to media inquiries on that front. New developments, Fresno County and Tuolumne County are now requiring that they take temperatures of all employees when they come to work, which is a bit concerning from our standpoint. Other than that, you know, it looks like whatever efforts have been made here in California have definitely slowed or flattened the curve here. So that's good news. That's about all I got at this point.
Very good. Thank you, Chris. We'll move on to trucking and H2A labor with Virginia Houston on our staff. Virginia?
Thanks, Pat. Good morning, everyone. My updates are very quick. For those of you who haven't been on the call for trucking, several weeks ago, the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration issued an emergency declaration waiving hours of service for truck drivers engaged in providing relief for COVID-19. That declaration has been expanded. It covers some ag inputs like livestock, fertilizer, and feed, but we have not seen an expansion since last week. So right now, seed is not covered under that emergency declaration. I imagine with the updated CESA guidelines, that will change sometime in the coming weeks. We do know that the FMCSA is considering expanding to include seed, but they have not made that determination just yet. So nothing new to report on the trucking issue this week. For labor, as Ellen mentioned, there is a new document on the Ask the COVID-19 website from the Department of Labor's Employment and Training Administration. This is for employers who employ H2A labor. For questions about how to handle issues during COVID-19, that document, again, is on the AFSA website. If you have any questions, let me know, and we can help you find the right answer. But that is all I have. Pat, back to you for seed testing and lab update.
Great. Thanks, Virginia. I did a survey this earlier this week to all of the regulatory and commercial labs to determine their status, and we'll have a copy of that report posted to our website. We had 63 labs respond, which I think is probably a majority of the business that's out there. 90% of them are still operating, and although some of the regulatory labs have are limiting their service samples, but most of the regulatory labs are not conducting field sampling. What I found interesting with the commercial labs is they've done a lot of things for work protection, including split shifts and, you know, just different programs like that, people working in the break rooms and all different types of things. But they're operating, and a couple of them even made a remark that they're available for looking for additional samples. So if you need to get some work done and maybe a lab you're working with is falling behind a little bit, it'll be fine. The regulatory labs, mostly are saying they're pretty restricted, and so they are going to fall behind a little bit. So, but all, both commercial and regulatory, have set up drop-off programs for samples, like a box outside their office or that type of thing. So I think we're okay in that regard with regard to the seed testing in the labs. I will toss out some kudos after hearing some of the stories of the way that they're working. The seed labs and the seed control officials are kind of some of the unsung heroes out there, and they're doing some really great work and hanging in there for us. And I just wanted to let them know that we appreciate how they're operating and what they're doing. So I know that Dr. Dunkel has some international labs and some phytosanitary issues. So with that, I'll turn it over to Rick. Rick, are you on? Are you muted?
Okay, thank you, Pat. I was on mute. Very much the same story with the National Seed Health System Labs that Pat reported relative to seed health testing. Of course, one of the large labs that is heavily relied on is the Iowa State Lab, and we've gotten strong assurances that they're doing everything they can to keep the lab in operations. They've done many of the similar things that Pat's talked about in the other labs, and many of you may know that Tracy Bruns, who's been sort of an influential figure in that laboratory, is moving over to APHIS, but Iowa State, with APHIS's permission, is retaining Tracy for an extra month so that they can get over this hurdle of keeping that lab operational. And so she'll be there, it looks like, at least through May. So that part's very good. But relative to, I might as well just do my phytosanitary report now because nothing much has really changed relative to APHIS. They're still operational when it comes to import-export activities, inspections, permits, issuing phytos, those kinds of things. The only change they've made here yesterday, excuse me, they announced some modifications to their mail service hours at their headquarters and hub facilities. And basically, like Riverdale, Fort Collins, Minneapolis are going down to mail service on Tuesdays and Thursdays until the pandemic's over. Raleigh, North Carolina will go down to just Tuesday. So they're encouraging customers, stakeholders to send their documents in electronically to the largest extent possible. That's pretty much what I have to offer.
Great. Jane, do you want me to jump in and do the rest of the international?
Well, maybe why don't we just go, Ellen, why don't we just go into Q&A for a minute, since that was a lot to cover?
Yep, just a second.
Any questions from those on the phone? Just press 01, as I said, and we'll have staff answer, or if there's an issue that you didn't hear about that you'd like some additional information.
First question coming
okay.
In.
All right.
Where can we find the 11 states that have not adopted the national critical infrastructure rules?
We can send that out in the follow-up notes. Quickly, as I understand, it's Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Iowa, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, South Carolina, Texas, Utah, Wyoming, and Puerto Rico.
Great. Thank you.
If you have a question, you can press 01 to ask on the phone, or you can also email me, ezimmerman@betterseed.org, and I'd be happy to read the question as well. We don't have any in the queue right now, Jane.
All right. Abigail, you're up.
Great. Thanks. A couple quick updates from the global perspective. The International Seed Federation is launching an effort to share information about the status of the seed industry from all of the member companies or countries. So AFTA is participating in that effort. And we've also been in contact with regional associations like the Seed Associations of the Americas and the Asia Pacific Seed Association, and we're sharing relevant information about phytosanitary situation, seed supply, whether seed is considered an essential business, and what the transportation bottlenecks look like. So feel free to contact us if you have any country-specific questions, and we can get those answers tracked down for you. There's also been some rumors that Customs and Border Protection is considering suspending the collection of normal import tariffs for a 90-day window to ease the expenses that U.S. importers are facing. But this would not apply to Section 301 tariffs on vegetable and flower seed from China. It would only apply to standard import tariffs. No action has been taken yet, but there's been quite a bit of chatter about this in the administration. So we will watch that situation and keep you posted. In terms of transportation, for ocean shipping, we're in regular contact with all the major U.S. port authorities. What we're hearing from them is that sailings continue to be canceled or delayed, primarily due to a decreased demand for imports coming into the U.S. We're all at home, so we're not going out to stores and retailers to purchase the typical standard volume. Earlier this week, there was a case of COVID-19 found on the crew aboard a container ship, and so the UN is responding to that, basically putting out guidance on quarantine procedures for the maritime industry that would ensure that the ship and the cargo on board are not caught up in a quarantine if the staff is on that, which would further delay sailings. Final point for air freight. We've been in contact with the major global courier services. We're hearing good news that some passenger flights are converting now to cargo only in efforts to increase capacity. But we are seeing freight rate surcharges for the time being due to the enormous volume of goods that are trying to be moved for air freight. So again, don't hesitate to reach out to us if you have any specific questions on the international front and with transportation. Thanks.
I did get a question via email looking for more detailed information on the situation for migrant worker and work visas.
Thanks, Ellen.
Question for you.
Yeah, so everything that we have on the current H-2A situation is on the AFTA COVID-19 website. If you're looking for something that's not on there, a specific question, you're welcome to email me. My email address is vhouston, H-O-U-S-T-O-N, like the city, at betterseed.org. The email is also on the website. So there's a general... several Q&A documents on that website from the Department of Labor, as well as sort of a running up-to-date through the news is what's being said out in the news and any documents put out by state, labor, or USDA.
So, Virginia, I think what we're hearing is that they're trying to expand the number of waivers for interviews for HGOA workers, and so we can keep those visas moving and keep the people moving forward. That program, you know, there a lot of that's happening in Mexico, but I think in other countries as well.
That's correct, Jane. They've expanded the interview waivers. So essentially, if you have a worker, even if it's their first time, who don't have any red flags as far as background checks, they probably will have that waiver issued for their interview. Again, also, we do have links to the COVID-19 updates for the State Department. So if you have a worker coming in from a country whose borders are closed, just keep that sort of thing in mind as you're getting your labor here. But the consulate in Mexico is still processing visas as of right now.
Thanks, Virginia. I have another question. Staff in Puerto Rico indicated that pressure is mounting for seed companies to shut down. The mayor called out Bayer and Cooper Vision, which is a lighting manufacturer. Others are calling out the entire seed industry. APHIS inspections are now Monday, Wednesday, and Friday only. This is mostly a statement, but what can be done to assist Puerto Rico?
This is Rick. Thank you for that information. I'll double back with APHIS and see what, if anything, they can do. And I'll get that information back out to y'all as quick as I find it.
So this is Jane. I know there are some organizations that are active in Puerto Rico, and I think perhaps given that the questions about Puerto Rico have popped up time and again, we're not exactly sure how much influence we can have in Puerto Rico, but we definitely, you know, we're happy to get engaged in the conversations there with the local organizations and our member companies that have operations down there to see if there are ways that we can be helpful. And I don't know if there's a role for the federal government in encouraging folks in Puerto Rico. As I understand it, there's the order that had been written for Puerto Rico is expiring soon, and they are going to be drafting a new one from the governor on the critical infrastructure. So this might be a good time to be weighing in to make sure that agriculture can continue to exist.
Yeah, it would be helpful, too, if you are getting any of the information from Puerto Rico, either the what's being called out, quote-unquote, from respect to the seed industry. It would be helpful if you could pass that on. We are involved in the various discussions that are going on with the commissioners of ag and the commissioner, the Puerto Rican, I'm not sure whether he's a commissioner or a secretary, as well as others that we can potentially work through down there going forward. So we'll touch base, as Rick said. He can reach out to folks from APHIS, and we can continue the process through NASDA. And as Jane said, we can step up through the Puerto Rican Biotechnology Council down there. Okay. Anything else there, Ellen?
Clarifying question about the 11 states. The question is, The 11 states aren't recognizing essential travel letters, or they don't require carrying essential letters?
No, so those 11 states have not adopted the DHS essential worker criteria. And they've either done their own thing or they haven't made it explicit what is essential worker, who are essential workers. So the goal, you know, the overarching goal is to have everybody working on the same system. My guess is that for each of those different states, they have kind of a different situation. But as a matter of fact, no government has explicitly created their own credentialing system for essential workers, or has really vocally said, you know, we'll accept this or not that. Generally, that is something that companies are doing on their own to provide a service for their employees.
Okay.
I think
Abigail.
I have a question here. 202-281-5996. You're unmuted. Go ahead and with your question. Okay. Must not have been a question. All set here in the queue then.
Okay, at this point, we'll go ahead and move into some of the things that were passed this week. The CARES Act that was signed by the president and the various activities or programs under that, as you'll hear from both our general counsel, Gary Kushner, and his colleague, George Ingram, this is changing rapidly, as in, I know we got an email last night, or this morning at 12 a.m., I think. So there's a lot of things going on at a very rapid pace. So with that, let me pass it over to Gary Kushner. Gary?
Thank you, Andy, and good morning, everybody. Hope you're staying safe. it's my pleasure to be with you today, and I am privileged to introduce my colleague, George Ingham, who's a partner in our law firm's employment and labor group. George has been living and breathing the developments during the COVID-19 pandemic, legislative, regulatory, and policy issues. In fact, the reason that Andy got an email at midnight or so last night or this morning is because George was reviewing the most recent regulation, 120 pages, that came out just last night. So he's up to speed on sick leave and the related issues. George, I turn it over to you.
Thanks very much, Gary, and thanks, everyone, for the introduction and letting me have an opportunity to speak with you all today. So I'm going to be covering a few different topics here. This situation, as Andy said, really is rapidly evolving. And it's such that if you're not staying on top of it, day to day, what you think was the law may no longer be the case. And as just an example, we were giving a webinar on Monday that touched on some of these state orders that we were just talking about earlier on this call. And in the midst of our discussion, three new orders were issued that had modified what we were talking about. So, sometimes the advice is not even current as you speak. So, but that said, I'm going to talk about some of these developments. I'm just going to jump right in because there is a lot to cover. So let's start with the topic of sick leave. So there is a law that was passed before the CARES Act, which was slightly modified with the CARES Act, and additional regulatory guidance has been issued, and that is called the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, or the FFCRA. And let me go through that with you. So the FFCRA is a new federal paid leave law, and it provides for paid leave for certain COVID-19 related reasons. And those are defined in the statute, and there have been additional glosses that have been placed on those in regulations and other guidance from the Department of Labor. The FFCRA only covers, if we're talking about private sector employers, it only covers private sector employers with fewer than 500 employees. So it's different than the usual law in which when you get over a certain threshold, you're covered. For this one, it covers only employers with fewer than 500 employees. There are some exemptions that exist. So if you have a business with fewer than 50 employees, there are certain circumstances in which you can exempt employees from a particular type of leave that I'll talk about. And very significantly here, the federal government is actually paying for the leave by reimbursing employers. And we'll talk about that a little bit more too. And that covers not only the amount that you're paying someone for the leave, but also a portion of health care that's attributable to the leave time. So with that, let's get into a little bit more detail here to understand this. And by the way, this law took effect April 1st, so it took effect this week. And I'll talk a little bit about, you know, how all this stuff is going to roll out. So let's jump in. So there are two buckets of paid leave that the FFCRA provides. One of these buckets is paid sick leave, and another is an expansion of the Family Medical Leave Act. So if you look first at paid sick leave, how much leave is provided? For full-time employees, 80 hours of paid sick leave are provided. That is prorated for part-time employees. And you only are eligible to use this leave if you meet one of six reasons in the law, and you have to be unable to work or telework for those reasons. So if you have staff that has the capacity to telework, and that's going to vary widely depending on job responsibilities, right? So somebody who needs to manually do work, that's not going to really exempt you, but you may have staff who can, and that's going to be significant in potentially excluding folks from the scope of the law. But so what are the reasons? One is that somebody is subject to a government quarantine or isolation order relating to COVID-19, so you can't get to work because of one of these orders. Two, you've been advised by a healthcare provider to self-quarantine relating to COVID-19. Three is that you're experiencing COVID-19 symptoms and seeking a medical diagnosis. Four is that you're caring for an individual who's subject to either a quarantine order or self-quarantine. Five is that you're caring for a child whose school or place of care is closed or child care provider is unavailable for reasons relating to COVID-19, or there's a catch-all which reserves the right for the Secretary of Health and Human Services to add additional categories. So far, none have been added, but it's possible that additional categories could be added. And again, you can use up to 80 hours of paid sick leave under these categories. For full-time employees, this amount is prorated for part-time. Now, the next question, how much do you get paid? For the first three reasons I talked about, which are essentially reasons where you yourself are unable to work because you're sick or you're self-quarantined or you're subject to an isolation order, you get paid 100% of your regular rate, capped at $511 per day. For reasons relating to caring for someone else, the employee is paid two-thirds of the regular rate with a cap of $200 per day. And what does the regular rate mean? For those of you who know the Fair Labor Standards Act, the term comes from the Fair Labor Standards Act. So the analysis that you would use to figure out the regular rate to determine overtime payments is the similar analysis you would use here. So just a couple of points to note. One, as I said, employees are not getting paid their full rates. Employers can pay more if they choose, so you can true somebody up. But if you do that, as I mentioned, the government is paying for this, but the government will not pay more than these caps. So if you want to true somebody up to 100% of compensation for employees who are earning more than or who would be entitled to more than these caps, if they were just taking normal accrued leave, you don't get a tax benefit and payment from the government. Another important point, employers cannot require employees to exhaust other forms of leave first. So you can't say to employees that you need to use up all your sick leave before you use this. So that's an important point. So that's the first bucket of leave, which is paid sick leave. The second bucket is family medical leave expansion. And this applies to, and by the way, the paid sick leave that I just talked about, that applies to all of your employees. For the family medical leave expansion, that applies to employees who have worked for at least 30 days, so it's going to be basically everyone. Those employees are entitled to leave for up to 12 weeks under the Family Medical Leave Act if they're unable to work or telework because they have to take leave to take care of a child, if their school or place of care is closed, or their child care provider is unavailable due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, if you take this leave, the first 10 days that you take is unpaid unless the employee elects to substitute other paid leave. And this, just like the paid sick leave, you get two-thirds of your pay for the duration of the leave, so after that first 10 days, capped at $200 per day. Now, a really important point, if you are already an FMLA-covered employer, one question that we've been getting from clients is, well, if an employee's already used up some of their FMLA balance for other reasons, does that mean that they have less of this leave to use? And the answer to that is yes. If someone has already used, let's say, 10 weeks of FMLA because they've had a prior serious health condition or they have used it for baby bonding leave or some other reason, that reduces the balance that is available here. So just to kind of bottom line this, you know, what should you be doing now if you're an employer with respect to the FFCRA and you are covered? Couple of points. One, you've got to make sure you're posting or providing the required notice. Please note, Department of Labor originally posted a notice that you have to post that is incorrect. They took it down and put up a new notice. So make sure that you have the latest version and that you're posting it. You should make sure that your leave policies have been reviewed and amended as needed to comply with the law. You should make sure that you have plans in place to get the documentation that you're going to need to receive reimbursement for the government, for the tax reasons. This stuff is available on the DOL website and on the IRS website. And also, don't forget your other obligations. The FFCRA does not relieve you of your obligation to provide paid sick leave if required under state law or to comply with any other federal or state or local requirements. And one final point is for those of you who have been staying up to date on this, be careful about the DOL website. DOL has been updating guidance on their website, not only by adding new guidance, but actually going through and changing some of the guidance that they have already added without announcement. So it's really important to stay up to date because some of these have been substantive changes. And what I'm telling you is the current version of things, but you really want to stay up to date here. So just a couple of small points, and then I want to make sure to move on to cover the other topics here. In regards to recent guidance, there are now regulations that have been issued. So there are actual regulations in the CFR. You know, some important points here. If you have fewer than 50 employees, as I mentioned, you can get an exemption from the expanded FMLA or the paid sick leave due to a school or place of care closing and you needing to take care of a child or the employee needing to take care of a child. But that is only going to be exemption when it would jeopardize the viability of the small business as a going concern. So you want to, this is an exemption where you don't have to ask DOL for it. An officer of the business can make a determination, and there are specific reasons that you can use to make this determination. It is a high standard. It's really looking at things like you can't operate in a minimal capacity, or you lack employees who you really need to run the business. But that is available if you are in one of these concerns. So that there's more information available on the DOL website and in some of the materials I understand are on your members only site as well. Another important point, the law is not retroactive. So if you provided leave before April 1st, the effective date, that doesn't count. So you still have to provide the full amount of leave after April 1st. Another point, Department of Labor, is observing a temporary period of non-enforcement for good faith violations through April 17th. That said, that doesn't apply to private plaintiffs, so you have some leeway here. If you make a good faith mistake and you remedy any violations promptly, but just beware that is not complete immunity. There is, for those of you with seasonal employees, there is a specific calculation that DOL just posted last night at I'm not sure when. So if you are trying to figure out how to pay your seasonal employees and what the rate is that you're going to calculate for them, you should check the DOL website. They have a frequently asked questions, and they just posted this. So you definitely want to check that out. I know that some of you, or many of you probably do, have some seasonal employees on your staff. Another point here is there's documentation requirements, as I mentioned. These are available both on the DOL and IRS website. Don't have time to go through all of these today, but you really want to make sure that you are getting that documentation, because if you're going to be looking to get the tax benefit here, which is basically paying for the entirety of this leave, you've got to make sure that you have the documentation to support that. So with that, all of that said, there's a lot of additional complexities here. But we've got to move on, and we've got to cover some other topics here in the time that we have. So let me stop here and move to the next topic on the agenda, which is the Paycheck Protection Program. And the Paycheck Protection Program is part of this CARES Act that everyone has been talking about quite a bit. The Paycheck Protection Program has been considered attractive to many because it provides a loan that is potentially forgivable if you meet the requirements. So it's not just a loan to businesses, but if you meet certain requirements, then the entirety of the loan can be forgivable. But there are requirements that come along with it, and it's really important to understand these. Another thing that's really important to understand is that it is very much expected that this program is going to be extremely popular and oversubscribed. So right now, if this is something that is of interest to you, you really need to be moving toward making an application for it as soon as possible. And so that's just a really important point, is this isn't something that that you really want to wait around on, because there's going to be a lot of interest. So what is it exactly? So it's a forgivable loan for up to the lower of 2 months of average payroll cost plus 25% or $10 million. To get it, you have to certify that, and this is really kind of the key, is you got to certify that current economic uncertainty makes the loan necessary to support ongoing operations. So that's an important point, is that you have to be able to certify that in good faith on the application. You also have to certify the funds are going to be used to retain workers and maintain payroll, or to make mortgage, lease, and utility payments. That you have not and will not receive another loan under this program. You're going to have to provide documentation to the lender. And by the way, these loans are provided through banks. So it's not a direct loan through the government, but it's through banks that the SBA, the Small Business Administration, is working with. And so to figure out if you have one of these banks, you may be banking with one already, if you are a small business, but otherwise you want to look at SBA.gov. Another requirement here is that you must be a small business under the SBA's size standards. Very roughly speaking, we're talking about a business with 500 or fewer employees. There are detailed rules about who is and who is not a small business. I will confess I'm not an SBA expert, but we have a number at our firm who are working around the clock on this. And there are, you definitely want to, if you are on the border there, you want to pay careful attention to see whether you can fall within those size standards. There is a sample application available right now at sba.gov that you can take a look at. And, you know, the things that, so going into, well, what can this loan cover? It can cover a few different things. Payroll costs and benefits, those are capped at $100,000 per employee annualized. Benefits including paid leave, separation and dismissal allowances, and group health benefits. State and local taxes on compensation, interest on mortgage obligations, rent and utilities. The loan will be due in 2 years. Payments are deferred for 6 months. The interest rate, which was set at 0.5%, now appears to have been changed to 1% this morning. And, you know, what is forgiven? Potentially the entire thing, but it's not going to be forgiven for money used on things other than those categories that I talked about, payroll, mortgage interest, rent, utilities. The SBA has indicated it likely will not forgive to the extent that more than 25% of the money is used on non-payroll costs. And the amount that's forgiven is reduced based on if you have to reduce your headcount or if you decrease salaries or wages by more than 25% for employees earning less than $100,000. There is a potential exception to be able to restore employment and salary levels by the end of June to eliminate these reductions. Again, if you are interested in this, it's really important to get in touch with an SBA bank as soon as possible on these issues. So that is the Paycheck Protection Program. Let's talk a little bit about some other provisions here, and I've been very focused on some of the employee-related provisions. Some of these are they basically all have different eligibility requirements and some different strings that are attached. So let's go through these at a high level, given the time constraints. So one of these is the Employee Retention Tax Credit. This is available to employers of any size. Covers the period March 13th through the end of the year, and basically allows you to get a tax credit equal to 50% of employee wages for a particular calendar quarter, and that includes health benefits, capped at a total of $10,000 in wages for all of the calendar quarters taken together that you're eligible for the program. So in other words, you can get $5,000 tax credits, because 50% of $10,000 for each employee. But there are two possible ways that you can be eligible, and this is the real question. Is one way that you can be eligible is that your business is fully or partially suspended due to a government order that limits commerce, travel, or group meetings due to COVID-19. Or the second way that you can be covered is if there is a sufficient reduction in your gross receipts during a calendar quarter compared to the calendar quarter the year before. So those are two ways that you can be eligible. And then the question is, well, which wages are going to be counted toward this tax credit? If you have 100 or more employees, based on the average number of employees you had in 2019, then wages that are qualified are wages paid during the period when employees are not providing services due to COVID-19, the idea being the government's trying to encourage you to keep people on payroll. For employers with less than 100 employees, it's wages paid at any time. So that is the Employee Retention Tax Credit. Important point. If you apply for the Paycheck Protection Program, if you get a loan under the Paycheck Protection Program, you can't also get this. So it's an either or. Another tax provision to keep in mind is that for all employers, you can defer payment of the employer's 6.2% share of Social Security taxes on employee wages. Half of that you can defer to the end of 2021. Half of that you can defer to the end of 2022. couple other points that are going to be of interest. Unemployment insurance has become much more generous to employees. The very high-level overview of that is that the federal government is now going to be kicking in an additional $600 per week through the end of July for any employee that qualifies for unemployment, either under the state standards or there's an additional federal standard that serves as a backstop. So if employees become eligible for unemployment, they are, if you take the average unemployment check of about $350, which is what you get on average from states, and add the $600, you're talking about approximately $1,000 a week in unemployment benefits. So that's something to keep in mind. State laws, some of them include these things called short-time compensation programs. Short-time compensation programs allow you to reduce hours of staff by between 10 and 60%. Employees then will get a pro rata share of unemployment. The federal government, through the CARES Act, has tried to make this easier for states to implement and to provide additional funding. So that is an option if employers are looking at doing something other than layoffs. There are also loans that are available to businesses as needed. These loans have some, in some cases, significant strings attached. For mid-sized businesses defined as those between 500 and 10,000 employees, you can get a loan to support ongoing operations in light of uncertain business conditions, but you have to certify the funds are going to be used to retain at least 90% of the workforce at full compensation and benefits through the end of September, and that you're going to restore your workforce to basically pre-pandemic levels within 4 months after the end of the public health emergency. Also, very significantly, you have to agree not to outsource or offshore jobs for 2 years after the term of the loan. You can't abrogate existing collective bargaining agreements, and you also have to agree to remain neutral in any union organizing efforts. So that's a potentially significant string attached there. There's also a disaster relief loan slash grant that is available. That is an SBA provision, so it's businesses with fewer than 500 employees, basically small businesses. Eligible applicants can get a $10,000 emergency grant that there is no obligation to repay. There are some conditions there, but if you receive a Paycheck Protection Program, if you're getting a Paycheck Protection Program loan, you can't also take advantage of the emergency $10,000 grant. There is also some additional, there are also some additional small business debt relief programs that are available. That is something that is basically an SBA program that is available for people who have or for businesses that have loans through that. So that is a high-level overview of a number of the different provisions in the CARES Act. There are a whole slew of issues here. This is all moving very quickly. Regulations were, are coming out really from a number of different places at the same time. But, it's just very important to stay up to date and to be ready to act quickly on these if you do intend to pursue them.
George, thank you very much for a comprehensive review. Just to remind everyone, our law firm, Hogan Lovells, does produce memoranda updates on these issues and many other regulatory and legislative developments, policy developments, and ASTA typically will post those on the members-only site. So please look for them. We're here to help. Thank you very much. And Jennifer, I think you're up next.
Yep, thank you, Gary. So just a quick update about our intended conference this June. Unfortunately, after careful consideration and conferring with our co-hosts, which was AOSA and SCST, the seed testing organizations, who are going to co-host our policy and leadership development conference with us this June. We have had to cancel the conference due to many issues related to coronavirus. It started with seed companies and seed labs having their own travel restrictions, and now as the situation has evolved, the JW Marriott itself, where we were going to have the event, is closed currently. I'm sure you've all heard about lots of furloughs for hotel employees, and the state of Indiana itself is under a stay-at-home order for a temporary period of time. It's probably going to be extended later today in a new announcement. So we are working on exploring ideas for virtual content programming that would be offered later this summer. There are two aspects to that. There's a lot of necessary ASTA business that's normally conducted at the June conference, and those elements will still be provided in virtual format. We're working on scheduling those things now. And in addition to that, we will be continuing to develop crucial issues content programming that would be provided over the course of the summer. And once we have those plans finalized, we will be notifying the membership about that. So if any of you were registered for the conference this June, the hotel has already canceled hotel reservations that were made within our group block automatically and emailed those people with that. And we are issuing refunds in full to registrants today. Actually, those are being processed for anyone who had been registered and paid to come in June. So, of course, it's very disappointing to us. This June meeting of ours has been held since 1883, and the only other time it's ever been canceled was 1945 during World War II. So it's a difficult year for the conference, but we'll all get through this and still be able to provide you some good information in the coming months.
Thanks, Jennifer. We're going to move into some question and answer for George or Gary, and then any other questions you might have as well. So 01 to ask a question, and you can always email me, ezimmerman@betterseed.org, to ask as well.
And while we're waiting there, Ellen, just so that everyone knows, there is a PowerPoint presentation that George gave earlier this week to one of their other groups that we have put up on the members-only website there in the COVID site. So please, if you have, if you want to review some of that, go ahead and do that on the website, and any additional questions we can ask here. But we know there's a lot there. We know there's also a lot of misinformation that we're concerned about with respect to the various programs that are out there. Our industry appears to be a little bit different for the most part, depending on what crop area you're in, but seems to be a little bit differently impacted in this. And so we want to make sure that we don't have our members going down a rabbit trail that may not be effective or helpful for them in the program. So with that, Ellen, you got any questions there?
Not seeing any in the queue here we go. Question regarding payroll protection plan. Because seed companies are seasonal in nature, we may not know the economic effects for 2 to 3 months when seed accounts are due to us. To what extent can we anticipate higher bad debts expenses that we won't know about until June or July?
That's a good question. I think that you have to certify in good faith. I will say that in terms of who is providing or sort of what the sense is on how much you can focus on future things. My understanding is that employers have been able to, or I shouldn't say able because we don't know who's been granted or not, but that employers are making this certification based both on current issues as well as anticipated future issues. But I think one important thing to note is that this is the Paycheck Protection Program is focused on really the next 8 weeks right now. So if you're thinking of things, multiple months into the future, that may be harder to focus on for purposes of this. But I don't think that there's necessarily a clear answer. And we have some folks within our firm who have really been in the weeds on the Paycheck Protection Program, and we could definitely provide some sort of detailed guidance on that point if that would be helpful.
Thanks, George. I will add, too, that there have been some already preliminary discussions with respect to future activities for an additional fund that would be helpful to companies and or sectors, depending on how this evolves in the coming months going forward. As George said, this is really looking at the next 2 months or 8 weeks. And there is discussion already about an additional one given the impact of various industries. And we've seen it within our agriculture community. Any of you that may be involved or know people involved in the dairy side of the business are really getting slammed right now. And that is an area that I know that there's a great deal of discussion on, can we do something for the dairy community? And if that happens, we likely will see it some programs for other communities as well.
Yeah, we've also heard about a potential additional package here. The terms of that are uncertain, but I've heard that as well on our end.
Yeah, still uncertain. I want to stress that, but it is something that the discussions are already out there. Jane, you want to go ahead and close this out?
Sure. As Andy just reminded everybody, we've got George's presentation on the leave is up on the members-only website, and I'm sure that Hogan Lovells will be developing more resources in the coming days, which will be added to the members-only resources. We always open the end up for additional questions that you guys might have. So we'll give you a couple minutes. If there's questions on topics that we haven't covered that you'd like us to be focusing on our work more. And also do let Ellen know if these calls are helpful for you and you want to continue them. We're looking for areas to tackle for next week. I know we had a great presentation last week from HM Close and Bex on what they're doing internally in their operations to manage during this time. And if you are looking for more resources for your own company and what to do day-to-day operationally, we're looking at some opportunities to connect you with training there. So do let us know if that's of interest. So with that, we'll just give you another minute. If you have any questions, now's your chance.
I'm not seeing any in the queue. I do want to just put a plug in for that members-only portal again. If you're having issues logging in or aren't sure how to get to that portal, please reach out to me, Ellen Zimmerman, and I'd be happy to make sure you're able to access those resources.
Thanks for emphasizing that, Ellen. Just one last thing from my standpoint, Andy Levine here. We are involved in a great number of calls on almost a daily basis as all of this is evolving. It is important that we understand what is impacting your business. It may be something outside of what we would consider the exact seed sphere, but if there are other things that are impacting or you have a question about something, please don't hesitate to reach out. We can quickly look into things. We can make some correlations with other groups that are in the food and ag sector, as well as transportation and labor. So we just need to make sure that we are up to speed on what's impacting you on a daily basis. We want to thank our regional, state and regional associations for the help that they've given us at that local level as each state tries to work through this on their own. And hopefully the information that we're providing back through them has been helpful to the process at that state level. So, again, thanks to everyone. Our best to you for a healthy and safe weekend, and we look forward to being in touch with you soon. Take care, everyone.
Thank you.
Goodbye.